Well, welcome back, everyone, to A Basic Conversation. Today, Father Basic and I will discuss the issue of race, racism, and racial understanding. And he outlined these topics in a lecture titled Bridging the Racial Divide. Father Basic, great being here again with you.
Did you listen to my lecture?
I did.
Did you like it?
Intently, yes.
And I think there were parts that weren't all that great, but go ahead.
Well, we'll save time at the end so you can improve on those parts.
Let's hope.
Or during where you can improve those parts. And that's part of the idea of the podcast is that we fill things in and try to extend the conversation, right?
I love it.
Yeah, me too. So you used the term bridging in several of your lectures, and obviously the idea of race is incredibly human, incredibly volatile, and it's very historical. And this idea of bridging the racial divide is a tall task, right?
For sure, yeah.
So we enter into this with great humility, this conversation.
For sure. I mean, the history is so difficult to deal with. I mean, obviously, live in a country in which slavery was a big part of the whole ethos of the country. The South became economically prosperous because of slave labor.
Right.
You know, we had a civil war and all of that. And in a sense, we're trying to recover from that.
Right.
It's part of our history, and that creates great disagreements on how to deal with that. What do you do with that history, you know? And one of the things that I think is that we can't hide it. We have to face it head on. Again, my bridging idea is always, how do we find a way to make progress? How do we find a way to talk with one another and to deal with this volatile topic so that we can move forward, so we can get beyond, not totally beyond, but try to do better in dealing with our racist history?
Right.
So, we have to deal with the history. I mean, slaves are brought to this country. I mean, we fought a civil war over it. We had a Reconstruction period that didn't go well at all.
Right.
Was trying to help the blacks and 40 acres of property and so on. And we, unfortunately, with the assassination of Lincoln, we got a totally racist president, Andrew Johnson, who torpedoed all the efforts at Reconstruction and opened the door for continued laws, the sort of Jim Crow laws in the South that were, you know, hurting blacks like before. I think the common experience often was that those black leaders, I mean, the white supremacists, you know, got back into power. Those people who were defeated in the Civil War often became members of Congress and had influence with Andrew Johnson and so on, and they found ways to control the blacks in the South, or to try to do that. So it's just a difficult history.
Yeah, and Father Basic, the overall umbrella of the lecture for me fell into this realm, and that was, we should listen to the black experience and the black voices. And then you walk through your lecture and you highlighted the black experience and the black voices.
Right, yeah.
And you started with, I believe, a professor, James Baldwin, who talked about, whites don't need to understand.
Let me go with that, I mean, I was a campus minister at Bowling Green State University,
right,
and James Baldwin was a guest lecturer there, and my friend, Sister Patricia Schnapp, wrote her doctoral dissertation on him and became friends with him and invited him to dinner. So we had a dinner party, eight of us and so on, with Jimmy Baldwin. Mm. And because of that, that's when we were talking, and Baldwin made the statement, clear in my mind, we blacks understand you whites because we have to survive. Mm. But you whites don't have to understand us blacks, and often you don't. And so that is, in my own mind, sets a leitmotif for the whole lecture in a way.
Right.
That Jimmy Baldwin says, James Baldwin says, you should know us, try to know us, try to see what's going on. And part of that, of course, is to know that history. I think I used Frederick Douglass.
Yes. Martin Luther King were two really...
Yeah, I tried to frame the lecture in terms of stories, mm-hmm. always thinking stories speak to people or you remember them better and so on. But Frederick Douglass is just a supreme person. I mean, an outstanding person. Grew up as a slave, of course. He learned to read. Mm-hmm. His mistress, the slave owners were big on no literacy for blacks because they feared if they learned to read, they wouldn't be submissive. And you'd end up with a lot of Nat Turner revolts and so on. And they were right in that. But his mistress, white mistress, started to teach him to read. And of course that got slapped down, but he found clever ways of dealing with the white kids around to learn how to read himself. I mean, amazing. And then he escaped to the North and so on, became this brilliant orator, educated man, traveled abroad, was in the White House with Abraham Lincoln, became an advisor and so on, and just an amazing story, a hero figure,
right,
for blacks who rose above their origins and circumstances and became extremely successful people.
Yeah, and then Martin Luther King, obviously iconic for what he did for civil rights and just for understanding. And a couple points that you made, one was you thought he did an excellent job in his written and spoken word about meshing spirituality with the constitutional right of freedom. You thought that was brilliant.
Boy, you picked up on the important one in my mind, Brad, as usual. Yeah. he got his degree from Boston University, was an educated man and could have had a career in theology,
right,
chose to be a pastor, and he's in Montgomery, he's just a new pastor, and the Rosa Parks things happen. You know, Rosa Parks was actually sitting in the back of the bus like she was supposed to.
And she wouldn't give up her seat.
But a white guy got on and didn't have a seat, and that's when she wouldn't give it up. And of course, that started the Montgomery bus boycott. But Martin Luther King, as part of the Ministerial Association, they chose him to give the first talk on this. He had a very brief time to prepare the talk, but he did exactly what you said there. His line was that if our cause, that is desegregation, if our cause of being able to ride the buses is wrong, then the Constitution is wrong, and Jesus is nothing but a utopian dreamer. Hmm. And that was the style that he used throughout his whole time. You look at his speeches, I Have a Dream speech, Memphis right before he died, they always combine something in the American dream, something in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, in Americanism, combined it with something from the Christian tradition that coincided with it, and it made a powerful package. That's why he was able to influence so many people, you know, because he put that together. And of course, from Jesus, and he developed the whole nonviolent thing.
Right.
And he traveled to India to learn more about Gandhi's approach to nonviolence. And then that became his whole mode of operation. It was so powerful. He was insistent. No, remember when his house was firebombed, his reaction was, nobody will pull me down to that level. No one will make me be violent in return. I will stick with the nonviolence that I get from Jesus. Said, put away the sword. Mm-hmm. Take up the sword, you're going to perish by the sword. Jesus was a nonviolent person. And Martin Luther was convinced that that was a practical strategy. That's what people today were opting for, nonviolence. It's worked. Gandhi freed a whole country from British rule through nonviolent methods. And Martin Luther King made great progress on civil rights by sit-ins in the lunch counters and so on, all nonviolent protests. In fact, if violence started to get out of hand in a march, he'd call the march off. We're not going to have that. We will resist with the gospel message of Jesus. Powerful stuff.
The letter from Birmingham jail.
Yeah.
Powerful, because he was directing his message to 10 or 11 white ministers in the community.
Yeah.
And calling out inaction and hypocrisy, but doing it in a way of within the realms of spirituality, scripture, and the Constitution. Again, incredibly challenging, but to call out your peers.
Yeah, really. Yes, that is such a great letter. He was in jail. He had no books.
He was writing it on
reference points.
He was writing it on.
And he's bringing up all this history and all the biblical material and so on. And of course, what the white ministers were advising him was, slow down.
Mm-hmm.
Don't hurry.
Change is hard.
Yeah. Go slowly, make progress gradually. And Martin Luther King said, the great danger are all these white moderates. You know, now is the time. Now is the time. You can't, in the Bible, there's a word kairos. It means the moment of opportunity. And this was the kairotic moment, the kairos, that we have to act now, and we have to carry on this nonviolent protest. So it's absolutely a brilliant theological piece, and put on notice all of us, in a sense. That was 1963, I think, that that he wrote that. And it was a time when, a lot of people were coming of age. We moved beyond the Eisenhower years. John Kennedy was elected president, 1960, and it was like there was a lot of foment. There were people against the Vietnam War. There was a general spirit of change and revolution and new things, sexual revolution and so on, all of that. And Martin Luther King saw that as a new opportunity to make progress on civil rights.
Are there other voices of the black experience that resonate with you, whether it be Nelson Mandela or Malcolm X or Bishop Tutu?
Yeah, some of my heroes. I've written a number of things about Nelson Mandela, and such a model. I mean, an activist. I always use him as an example of how we all have racist tendencies. When he was part of the anti-apartheid movement, and sometimes he had to raise money. And he tells this story himself. He was flying out of someplace, Johannesburg, I think. And he gets to the airport, and he gets on the plane. and the pilot is black. And he starts thinking himself, I wonder if this guy knows how to fly this plane. This is Nelson Mandela, the great icon of anti-apartheid, of racial equality. He himself is suffering from this. So I always use as an example, if somebody says, I'm not racist, you might want to think more carefully. How do you feel if the pilot's black, you know, or your doctor's black, or whatever else happens? It's just a marvelous teaching device in my mind to raise. We all have to raise our consciousness and admit where racist ideas are going. But Nelson Mandela, he's in prison all these years, and that was tough go at the beginning.
Sure,
they wouldn't let the black prisoners wear long pants. They forced him at times to eat without forks out of a cup. It was debilitating. It was dehumanizing and so on. But they
had 27 years.
Yeah, a long time. I always say there was a time if you said to people, Nelson Mandela is going to be president of South Africa, they say you're nuts, you know. But he lived through all of that, and he did it without becoming rancorous, without becoming violent, without becoming excessively neurotic over it. So he gets out, and is elected president of South Africa, black man. Apartheid is over. And what he does is he invites some of his jailers to the inauguration ceremony and has them sit up front. Reconciliation. I mean, this is hard to believe. I mean, this man was a moral compass for the world. He was a person who had every reason to strike out, to get an enemies list that you're going to go after and get back at. Yeah. And instead, he invites these people to his inauguration. That's a great model of a Christian outlook on life.
Yeah. The other aspect of the lecture, you kind of then went through and kind of looked at some of the demographics or some of the areas of society as far as how are blacks doing in the area of voting and education and housing, social, in criminal justice. You gave kind of a reality, but then also some progress, especially, I guess, education struck me that you felt that there was some progress in that area, but a lot of the other areas still some significant challenges.
I mean, you start out by saying the African Americans are about 13% of the American population, and then say, well, how are they represented, you know, in Congress, for example? They're underrepresented in Congress. They're underrepresented in the business world and in the educational world. They're overrepresented in the prison population. You know, the numbers vary depending on whether you got local jails included or federal prisons and so on, but 13% of the population and a much higher percentage of the prison population. And those stories of getting picked up for driving while black, I mean, those are real. Every black person I know has been picked up for no good reason. You have senators who've been 5-6 times say they've been stopped. There was the son of a Philadelphia black mayor in Philadelphia. His son was driving his big Lincoln car, and throughout the day he got stopped like 10 or 12 times in one day. It just happens. I remember a friend of mine saying that a black friend was visiting him and was going to use his car to drive someplace, and he said, well, I need a paperclip. And the woman whose house he was in said, well, what do you need a paperclip for? Because I'm going to clip my license plate and registration to the shield. so that I don't have to reach into my pocket to get it. That was just part of his routine. I mean, it's
foreign to us.
Yeah.
But for the
black your parents did not have to give you a lecture on what to do when you were stopped by the police. Yes. They said, don't speed too much.
Yes.
You know, don't, but they didn't have to give you the lecture that every black family has to give to their offspring about driving.
So the we're talking about bridging, but then we have these flashpoints, like when George Floyd was murdered. It was an incredible inflection point for us as a country.
Yeah.
And what does that do for this idea of bridging?
Yeah.
It's an opportunity. I think when anything like that, I've heard you say before, it's an opportunity to get better.
But you're right. It had an impact greater than most anything you could think about. I know in my neighborhood, I have black neighbors, and down the street, out in the main street, after the Floyd thing, there were three young people, two guys and a girl, standing on the street corner with signs about Black Floyd, about the Floyd thing. I thought, what? I mean, what happens in our country that gets that much attention? I don't think there's not much that influenced us on race as much as that, and it was so graphic, and then the trials, and
we can contrast that too with from 2008 to 2016 we have an African American president.
Yeah.
So there's some sense that's great, but then we have all the underlying societal issues still there, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about the whole situation, I mean, that's what everyone will bring up. Well, society can't be racist because we elected a black president twice,
Mm-hmm.
And I often think that he personally and was free of all scandal. You know, I mean, if you think about presidents and all the stories about John Kennedy and all that, and you don't have those stories about Barack Obama. And I think that he was just so sure and assured, and what do I want to say? He wasn't going to mess it up. I think that was right. And I think that a lot of blacks thought he should have done more. As the president, he should. Mm-hmm. It is a criticism of him, and I mean, he did do things. He had blacks in his cabinet. He campaigned for blacks to Congress. But when you think about getting things done for blacks, the person who comes to my mind is Lyndon Johnson, a Southerner from Texas. I mean, after Kennedy's assassination, he got through the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act of 65. I mean, that was an amazing accomplishment. You know, the voting thing for blacks, let's stay with that for a while, okay?
Yeah.
So they couldn't vote, obviously, as slaves. After the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment essentially gave them the right to vote. But in actuality, a tiny percentage of blacks voted because it was made hard for them. You know, they had all these ways of suppressing the black vote. And that, the history, how do I want to put it? That really continued to be a problem in the South all the way up till 1965. Still, you had legislation that said you can't do that, you know, that blacks have to be free to vote and so on. So a white Southerner from Texas, Lyndon Johnson, deserves, in my mind, so much credit for accomplishing that. And of course, Martin Luther King was, they were close at one time, shows the power of Martin Luther King again. Martin Luther King had the ear of Johnson. He helped him pass that legislation. And then Martin Luther King opposed the president on Vietnam and broke that. It shows the moral power of Martin Luther King to be consistent. I think I'm losing the thread of my thought here, but I was on voting, right?
Yeah.
So then, and part of the Voting Rights Act was that the traditional states who had been suppressing the voting could not introduce new laws suppressing voting without running it by the federal government. Well, for some reason, I'm not remembering the name of the Supreme Court case. It was a county, anyway. The Supreme Court later pulled back on that. And at that point, the southern states, this is after 65, I think it was Holder versus a county someplace. Anyway, and at that point, right as soon as the Supreme Court made that decision, the southern states don't have to check with the federal government to put in new laws. They all started passing laws again. So the
making it more difficult.
Although that is a very controversial topic,
sure.
And maybe we'll, if we have time, get to it. But yes, that's the common perception of whites, liberals, that the southern states put in all of these suppressive laws and so on.
Let's talk
They deny that. That's the point. They deny that that is what's happened.
Right.
Go ahead.
And it's just a tightening up of things. And,
yeah, just have everyone have a photo ID and don't bring food to people in line and so on. Yeah.
Right. White privilege and white fragility. We're two white males here talking about race.
Yeah.
And so for me, it took me a while to understand white privilege. I mean, probably almost till I was 50.
Yeah.
And it came during a lecture where a presenter got in our face about white privilege. And I got really defensive.
Oh.
Because I'm thinking I'm treating everyone with respect and being thoughtful of people and minorities. And it took an African-American mentor friend to kind of hyper me down and walk me through it. So now he helped me understand that even though Brad Rieger worked hard to get where he's at, that I started way ahead of my people of minority.
Yeah,
I started 50 yards ahead because I was a male, white. I came from a an economically sound two-parent home. I was education was all around me, and throw in athletics, I had doors open for me for that. So it took me a good part of my life to realize that it doesn't mean I didn't work hard. And it doesn't mean I'm not deserving of things.
No.
But I just started way ahead of people. And what does that say to me then as far as how do we assist and try to make it more equitable for people of color? It just took, it sounds really good what I said right now, but it took me a while to get there.
That's a beautiful statement. That's a great witness for sure of what you said. You've made the point better than I did in the lecture, that's for sure.
I'm sure you inspired me.
That's a great personal story. And I think it's got all the elements of helping all of us to do that. So I'm the same way. I grew up in privilege. And I also grew up in a neighborhood that was all white. I went to Catholic schools that were all white. Played sports against blacks. But so I grew up in that kind of thing. And I had every advantage. You know, I could say the same story that you said. And I like the way you said that it's not that we should feel guilty about that. That isn't the point. The point is to realize that some people started behind.
Yes.
And if that's true, and it is true, we were privileged, but now we should be in a position of trying to help those people.
Yeah. How can we be allies?
Yeah. Yeah, how can we help those people to move forward? It sets the stage for really trying to overcome racism and doing our own part and so on. I think what you've done is add a dimension. We should feel grateful for what we've got, the privilege we've got. We should realize that a lot of people didn't have that privilege. Yep. And how can we help them in various mm-hmm. ways? But we help them not in a patronizing way, but how can we assist or empower or listen better to them?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a way of coming at it.
Yeah. And let's finish with this. And during your lecture, you mentioned something briefly. Back in the 60s, one of your experiences was you attended a rally. Was it a Black Panther rally?
No.
What was that?
When I was the only white.
Yeah.
Oh, that was at Bowling Green State University.
Oh,
I was
okay.
A campus minister, and the Black Student Union,
okay, Black Student Union
was having a meeting, a big meeting and so on, and I went as a campus minister, and I was the only white there, and I've been in that situation other times. I was comfortable with mm-hmm. it, and until one guy got up in the meeting and said, well, we could discuss this, but there's certain people here.
You were the certain people?
I was the certain people here, which wouldn't allow them to discuss it. I was thinking about a black pastor who was influencing me, Franklin Freeman. He had a church on the east side of mm-hmm. Toledo. He was a colleague in interfaith things, and periodically he invited me to come to his church and to preach, and it was just wonderful. I mean, we got there and everyone's gathering around talking and everything, and there's music, and I said, Franklin, have we started yet? But Franklin's great advice, and I preached, and Franklin's great advice is, let them lead you.
Wow.
They'll pick up the rhythm. You're not going to impose your rhythm on them. I'll tell you that right now.
Great advice.
They will impose their rhythm on you speaking because they will put an amen in when they want it in there.
Yes.
And when that's time for you to pause and to let it sink in and then move on. So those were great experiences. And it was an example of trying to learn from the Black experience.
Yeah. Bridging the racial divide, we have much work to do, but thank you, Father Basic, for giving us some thought-provoking avenues to explore.
Let's keep that same model in mind that, hey, we've made progress.
Yeah.
We did have a black president. We have a black vice president. We've come a long ways. There's a higher percentage of blacks voting and so on. But there's so much more to go. Brad, can I borrow a couple minutes yet?
You sure can.
No, here's the thing. And the whole argument is the country racist or not. What happens is, you didn't have slaves, I didn't have slaves. Jefferson had slaves, we didn't have slaves and so on. But slavery has injected itself into the mindset of the country. And so there's such a thing as social sin. Social sin means that sin gets embedded in institutions, so that institutions are not fair or equal, so mm-hmm. blacks are not making the same money as whites are making and so on. And that produces false consciousness.
Mm.
That's false consciousness when we don't see it.
Right.
You know, it's just part of our life. So it's another way that the Catholic approach is social sin, false consciousness, and what you need are prophets. Like the people you brought up, you need prophets to tell you, hey, you're not seeing it right. That's what Martin Luther King did for many of us. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the extra time.
Great way to end. Thank you, Brother Basic.